All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. At the back end of today's show, we're going to hear another piece from the talk by Bob Avakian, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible." And this is taken from the Q&A after that speech was delivered. And he's going to be responding to the question, how do we know how much time we have left before fascism fully consolidates? And opening the show up, given the renewed attacks on women's right to and access to abortion, we're going to hear an interview I did with abortion doctor Willie Parker on his memoir, Life's Work.
All right, I recently read a book that when I saw the title of it, I had to get it. And it was because it's something that I've paid a lot of attention to over the last few decades. And in particular, this book was also written by a person that I really have followed what he's been doing and admired what he's been doing and think he's actually doing work that is absolutely necessary. I consider him actually a very courageous hero in the world today. His name is Dr. Willie Parker, and his book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. Glad to be here.
Sure. Well, let's jump into this right away. You've said that actually, and I think this characterizes a lot of what you do, you said you want to make it so abortion occupies the moral high road in society, in the world today, and it's something that actually has not been done, but it's actually something that you've dedicated your life to doing. Let's talk about why.
Well, you know, I would like to make abortion be a non-issue morally. Abortion should be no more moral or immoral than a person taking care of their health, and in this case, women. Taking care of themselves means that they should have the right, that they are morally entitled to the right to make decisions about their health, their lives, and their body. If I say a moral high road, if we say that the opposition to abortion it can be found on the road of morality, then I think the right to have an abortion has to be placed on that same road by allowing people who are opposed to abortion to turn it into a moral issue with no counter narrative or no alternative position on that. Is by default to make women taking care of themselves a moral issue and more in particular to make it an immoral issue. And I think that has allowed policymakers and people who see the world a certain way to elevate their position to one superior over the interest of a woman that she should be allowed to have in herself.
Now, one of the things that happens in all this is, which is also something you speak to right away in your book, and I thought it was very interesting that you did, you start off the book with a statement that one rarely ever hears, that as an abortion provider, I'm doing God's work. And this kind of captures a lot about your life and your role in the world. It also captures a lot of what the terms of the battle are with these people who are the anties out there who actually do want to chain women back in the prehistoric times, who basically want to make it so that women's bodies are controlled by men. They don't have any moral or actual real control over their body, or nor should they have it. So you actually have argued this as you're an abortion provider doing God's work, and that's going right up against these other people who also argue that they are doing God's work.
Sure. What it does is two things. Number one, the reality that for me, the reason I do this work, to make public my religious beliefs and my understandings in the context of the work I do, it wasn't anything strategic or tactical. It was to speak the truth about from where I live my life and where I get my values from. They are rooted in my understanding of Christianity, which for me became a conscious decision to pursue when I was 15 years old. And in that I've for so long held my beliefs as personal and most relevant to me has been why I've been most uncomfortable putting them in the public domain. But to the degree that those of us who understand the morality of a woman making her own personal decisions, to the degree that it's religious for any of us, it has to be religious for all of us. And so for me, just as people who are opposed to abortion and related to their religious or God understanding, and then they say that it prompts them to oppose abortion from a place of religious judgment, I come at my understanding about what I'm supposed to do and feel for other human beings in the context of religious compassion. Compassion is also to be found in religion, and it is simply the notion that the greatest action you can take on behalf of another person is to help them in their time of need. So people who are opposed to abortion are entitled to their opinions and even their religious beliefs about them, and so am I. if I say I'm supportive of abortion and they say that they are against abortion, we're each entitled to believe that. My notion is that with each of us having opposite notions, the public conversation around the morality of abortion should be canceled out within religious understanding. And what we should be really left with is the person who has to make the decision about whether or not to have an abortion. They should be left with what their inner voice is telling them. If one sense of morality is personal and deeply spiritual and should govern you, then my position on abortion or the position of a person opposed to abortion should not be overbearing to a woman as she's having to make this decision.
Now, you've argued, and your training as a scientist and your actual involvement with science from the time when you were a teenager is actually really important in relation to all this, too. And it's actually, you've said that for you, not carrying out abortions and not living out the convictions you have would be a fate worse than death. Let's talk about that.
Well, what I mean by that is we all live from a place of what means most to us and being true to oneself. As a scientist and understanding and appreciating the world in an evidence and empirical-based way, the natural forces of life, the scientific, biologic realities of life, they are indifferent to what my beliefs are. You know, the sun comes up whether I believe in it or not. Gravity is a force that works whether you believe in it or not. So having that appreciation or an empirical appreciation for the world and reality sit side by side with my non-empiric appreciation for reality. And that is what we found in my spiritual understandings of things that are equally important to me, and they are deeply personal. Whereas the scientific realities aren't personal, they are there and we all stand equal before them. My religious beliefs are quite personal. And because they're personal and subjective, they may not work or be plausible or palatable for someone else. And so it's with that understanding that I hold both of my identities in an integrated way. And so it's because I understand that my beliefs are personal, I have to decide when I'm working and living in the world and interacting with other people, which frame of reference is going to be most relevant. The one when it comes to making decisions about policy, about how we are going to allocate resources, about what freedoms and liberties and restrictions we're going to make for people, those have to be related to the thing in our world and in our reality that's most objective. And the most objective things are empirically based decisions or conclusions that we reach via science. And as I say that, I repeat the words of Albert Einstein when he said that not all that matters can be counted, and not all that can be counted matters. I'm not making an argument to say that if it's not based solely in empirical understanding, that it's not important. What I am saying is the things that should govern how we make our decisions as we live a community have to be based on the things that we all stand objective before. Religion is not one of those things, but science is.
Very important. And one of the things that you look at today, I mean, look, abortion rights, as I was reading your book and as I'm going through this and I'm thinking, abortion rights today is under an unprecedented attack. I mean, more so than ever before. And it's a battleground, and it's a very dangerous battleground for women on many different fronts. And you're in the middle of that. Let's talk about how you see that battleground.
Well, I see the ability to turn a biologic reality like the fact that 1 in 3 women in their lives will end a pregnancy. And the pregnancies that are in this country and around the world, the majority of them that are ended are ones that are unplanned and unwanted. But unplanned does not mean unwanted, because over half of unplanned pregnancies are continued. And the ones that are unwanted and unplanned are the ones that end up in abortion. So something that is that common and that is a part of the biologic reality of women cannot be placed in the realm of people's preferences or likes and dislikes. Women need to have access to abortion care because we know empirically without question that when abortion is legal, it is safe and accessible, and when it's illegal, it is unsafe and it is very dangerous. We now have people who have grabbed power who, because ideologically they find abortion and the biological reality that women need to end pregnancies distasteful, means that those of us who understand the importance of abortion from a safety standpoint can't stand by and watch what we know will happen if people are allowed to, because of their ideologies, they're allowed to control the health and lives of people who don't share their ideology. So it is a battleground, for lack of a better metaphor, because on both sides of this issue, people who are deeply convinced of what they think about it are motivated to defend their position. But what also makes it a battleground is that the argument, or at least the issue, is often framed in the context of what I call a false equivalency. The pro-life, pro-choice narrative has lent itself very well to people oversimplifying what the abortion decision is. And it is not one simply of pro-life and pro-choice. As a person who provides abortions, I'm pro-life. I'm pro-life of the mother. And so within the context of being against abortion or supportive of abortion, there's an element of choice in both of those sides. If you are against abortion, you can choose not to have one. And if you find yourself needing an abortion, you can choose to have one. But the pro-life, pro-choice narrative lends itself unnecessarily to battle conflict, which makes the analogy of war a very apt one.
Now, Dr. Parker, you've also said, and some of the stuff that you're talking to leads right into this, it's like very few doctors today have abortion as a specialty, even though almost every doctor is trained in one way or another to handle abortions. What's the scene here? I mean, what is it that actually has created a situation where residents train to do abortions, but the vast majority of them don't end up doing them? And overall, there's been an extremely sharp decline, as I understand it, in the numbers of abortion providers out in the world today.
Well, there certainly would have been, because of the politicizing of the issue, the domestic terrorism around the issue, where people have been harmed, have been 11 people killed, 4 of them were doctors, in the context of providing abortion care. That certainly has made what I call for non-democratic dissent against abortion, even though abortion remains legal through terrorism and exploitation of regulations. Those opposed to abortion have been able to punch again above their weight, if you will. And what I mean by that, if you look at the fact that the majority of people in this country, over 50% of people approve of abortion in some form or some fashion, the fact that we now have hundreds of local restrictions on abortion, even though abortion remains legal, has resulted in this hostile environment where people who could provide abortions don't. People who are now training in abortion care, many of them have been restricted in access to abortion education, because a lot of medical education occurs at the hospital and clinical level in Catholic hospitals, which often have charters and mandates prohibiting access to abortion or training around abortion. So one of the things we've been trying to do is gain more control over the regulations of medical education to require people to train in abortion care. And so there are certainly the regulations that are shifting, but there's also the kind of consumer demand. And by that, I mean young people who are entering into medicine, who are aware of the loss of access, they are actually seeking medical education that will provide them with the training to provide abortion. So organizations like Medical Students for Choice at the medical school level, women's studies and reproductive rights and reproductive justice, or interest groups at the college level, are informing people of abortion access challenges, and those people are aspiring to enter into medicine with the intent of becoming abortion providers. You have people who are pursuing education as non-physicians who are fighting for the right to be able to provide abortions, like nurse practitioners, midwives, and the like. So there's a consumer demand, but it's been thwarted in large part that even as abortion remains legal, again, domestic terrorism around people being harmed and injured, perpetually harassed and marginalized in their choice of a medical career, that is kind of cowering people away from providing the care. But I think that that's changing.
Now, what about the question, though, that also comes up a lot in relation to if women can't find somebody to actually give them an abortion, if they can't find a doctor or a clinic or something, or they can't afford it or whatever, they oftentimes turn to do-it-yourself abortions. And that seems to be a major plague in the world today, and directly a product of the kind of oppression that you're talking about coming down around women. Let's talk about that.
Well, actually, to your point, the majority of abortions that happen today in the world happen under unsafe circumstances, because the majority of them happen in places around the world, especially developing countries that have been controlled by people with fundamentalist religious understanding or very patriarchal ones. In those places, abortion is illegal, and in those places, that's where we see the greatest number of mortalities related to abortion. The mortalities come from the reality that I wish people would simply understand that a woman or a person who's pregnant and they don't want to be, when they are resolved to not be pregnant, they will do whatever they need to do to end that pregnancy, such that a woman will choose illegal or unsafe abortion to end the pregnancy versus acquiescing to the reality of having a safe, legal pregnancy. So it's to say that women will do whatever they need to do. They will choose something that's potentially life-threatening if it's going to allow them to accomplish their reproductive goal, even when they could simply acquiesce and do something that would be safer. So women are committed to achieving their reproductive goals and not having their lives controlled by the interest of others. And so what that means is when we outlaw abortion, we don't make it less frequent. We make it less safe. The reality is that before Roe and after Roe, the number of abortions were approximately the same. What was different is the number of women who died from abortion. Deaths from abortions in this country became virtually nil from unsafe abortions. There's an intrinsic risk to every procedure, no matter how skilled the person is or no matter how optimal the circumstances are. People sometimes die. When you see a person goes in for a routine tonsillectomy and they don't wake up, there's an intrinsic risk with every procedure. But we know that when abortion is safe and is legal, that it is so safe that women rarely die from abortion. But yet when it's illegal and women are taking desperate measures, abortion becomes extremely risky. And the implications go beyond just a woman losing her life. Many women who have abortions are already parents, so that means children become orphans. Women have abortions are already partnered. That means that spouses or lovers lose a partner. And so there's an impact as a society. If those people were working, we lose people who can contribute. So there's losses on multiple levels when we lose sight of the fact that simply outlawing abortions doesn't make them less frequent. It only makes them less safe.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Willie Parker, and we're talking about his life's work. And his book is called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Now, you've argued that there is an analogy between putting limits on women's reproductive rights and slavery.
Yes, I know that sounds like bombast in a country that has a horrendous legacy of slavery and racism. And it sounds like bombast, especially when we live in a country that has that legacy, but is unwilling to talk about race in a meaningful way. But all of us have some form of reference with slavery. Even the most sanitized notions of slavery, people understand that people were owned by other human beings and that those people's lives and wills and activities were controlled by the interests of other people. I can't think of a more apt or more direct analogy to denying a woman access to control over her body. So even for people who don't come from a legacy of slavery, in order to understand what it means when a woman cannot make her own reproductive health decisions, you simply need to understand that when captured Africans were under the control of people who economically used their labor for their own benefit and took away the self-determination of those people, that is no different from us reducing women to breeders when we say that they cannot control their reproduction and they are forced to continue pregnancies that they never wanted or that the ones that they wanted but that became dangerous for them to continue. I know that, again, perspective and proportion have to come into play, but if one understands the degree to which folk would control, then one would see that there is a sense of proportionality to making that assertion.
Now, one of the things, and this is a fairly heavy thing because it actually plays out all the time, or it's in the background, actually more in the foreground these days, because something that people never really thought about very much, even though it's been going on for a while, and it's especially increased over the last couple of decades, is the danger to doctors who decide that they are, in fact, no matter what, they are going to provide abortions to women who need them. And there's been an occasional spurt here and there of doctors being killed, doctors and people that work in abortion clinics being killed. And it comes out now, even in terms of when places are surrounded, like you talk in your book about when you go to work every morning, you have to get out and you have to wonder in your own head what's going to happen between getting out of the car and getting to the door of the office of the abortion clinic. You know, and this whole idea that your life can be taken by someone who is so deeply opposed to the humanity of women that they're going to stop the one person that they think is actually ruining the lives of women, which is you, the doctor. And you said you have no desire to die prematurely, which, again, as I'm saying, is a real threat. But you're more intent on avoiding a death of spirit than avoiding harm for doing abortions. I thought that was something really important for people to consider and to hear your thoughts on.
You know, they say that you can't be brave unless you're scared. And I am like anybody else. I have value for life. And I know that sounds provocative to people who reduce life to an event by saying that life begins at conception and they fancy that a developing pregnancy is a person. But I am not any different from anybody else in that regard. Dr. King said that as well when he says, like anybody else, I want to live a long life. It has its place. But he says if a person has been found something that they live for to the point that in their pursuit of it, they might be injured fatally, that person is not fit to live. And he said, if you at 35 become afraid to do what you know is right in your heart, and you live another 65 years, when you finally start breathing, it's just a belated announcement of something that's already occurred. So I'm more, as you said, I decided that I can live with the fact that someone might try and harm me for doing what I know is the right thing. I don't know that I could live with myself if I had to face on a daily basis that I consciously became afraid to do what I knew was the right thing to do simply because someone threatened me. I have no desire to die prematurely, but the other way that I manage that risk and that possibility is to understand that we all have to choose what we live for and not pay so much attention to what we might die from, because we're all going to die. You know, I'm no more detached to being here. This is all I know. We can speculate about what's after, if there is an after, and that's what comes in the domain of our religious understanding. But when it comes to dealing with the reality every day, we all have to decide what counts. And Dr. King said that the most important question that you will have to ask yourself at the end of your life, or that someone may ask of you, is what did you do for others? It's not going to be whether or not you had a degree or how much money you had. It's what did you do for others? And to me, that's a very central principle for my life. In order for my life to have meaning and purpose and to count in the way that I want it to, I simply have decided that the way that I've chosen to serve women gives my life the meaning and the purpose that lets me get up every day and be fully aware that someone might be willing to harm me. But as long as I continue to focus on the rightness of what I do and who it helps, then I don't spend time worrying about how I might die.
Now, on the one hand, you have all the assaults on the doctors and all the assaults on the right of women to have abortion that are out there in the public sphere, and they're all being pushed out. And you see it, you know, if you pay any attention to it, you see the hordes of anti-abortionists, people who are actually out there really trying to take women back to the Middle Ages or to keep women in their place and deny their humanity and all their rights as a human being. And you actually, at the same time, have had to confront not only those kinds of attacks, but you've also had to confront the reality that there's a tsunami of regulations that have been poured out to actually make it almost impossible for you to actually do the work in any kind of way where you can just walk in and do your work and know that you're doing good and deal with it. You have a whole pile of just this, you know, barrel of regulations that are hitting you from every day, from every angle. And I know you were in the movie Trapped, which was a very powerful movie, and it actually spoke to some of this, how this tsunami of regulations is really meant to, one, hit at the doctors, but also to sort of make it so that there's, to try and seal off the abortion clinics and the people willing to do abortions from the women who need them.
Yes, it's hyper-regulation, it's abuse of regulatory authority. Each state has a Department of Health, and that Department of Health is charged with protecting the health and well-being of its citizens. And it's interesting to me that ideologically, some people have chosen to grant citizenship to unborn pregnancies at the expense of the women carrying those pregnancies. And so while they've not been able to successfully overthrow the law of the land in terms of the Roe decision, although it feels to me like we're on a road to make that happen, in the absence of that in the past 44 years, what they've done is functionally gutted the provisions of Roe. That the thing that stands between states carrying out their own agendas around reproductive rights, the thing that stands between that and women's access has been that Roe says that in the first trimester, nobody can outlaw abortion. But now you have states that said, okay, if we can't outlaw the abortion, we're going to make you wait as long as possible because we're going to create some notion that you, when you make your decision, you need more time to make it. We're not going to provide funding that would support poor women to have the same access to services that women of means would have. We're going to have regulations around how wide the halls can be or how many bathrooms are there, various ways in which you can create regulations that appear to have something to do with safety, but in no way at all do they have any bearing on the content of abortion care. So it's been an abuse of regulatory authority to, in essence, legitimize the idealized position of folk who are against abortion. You can't walk into a state house and say, the Lord told me that abortion is evil, so as a state, we shouldn't do it. But you can walk in and say that fetuses are babies, and we have a compelling interest in the state to protect the life of all of our citizens, and we have a compelling interest to protect the lives of the women, even though we know without a doubt, incontrovertibly via evidence and studies, that abortion is one of the safest, most common procedures, and there's no question that when women have access to safe abortion, their lives are protected and preserved. So some people say that when you live in a society, there can be an inverse correlation between the presence of justice and the number of laws. Or in other words, when you live in a just society, you don't need laws to make people conform to justice. A just society, people will willingly participate and abide by the rules of that society. So the injustice of denying women access to abortion is often perpetrated paradoxically by increasing laws that pretend to create justice when they do anything but.
You know, it's one of the things that actually happens around a lot of this is the attacks on abortion are often rooted in these what you've called wildly false concepts that are completely opposed by the actual truth of the matter. And following along with that is that getting an abortion, being pregnant and deciding that you want to get an abortion is the one condition that is treated like it's sort of a sacred thing, and women have to go through all kinds of hoops to try and even just decide to say, no, I want an abortion. It's my body. I want to actually get an abortion. I'm not going to deal with this. And they have to prove to authorities that they've actually thought carefully about abortion. Somebody who has cancer, gets a tumor, doesn't come in and decide that they've thought carefully about whether or not they should deal with it. They say, look, I want to get it treated. But with this, where you have this situation with women and they're being really sort of penned in and basically prevented, and there's attempts to prevent them from doing what they actually want to do and what's available and necessary if they want to do it. Again, going back to this thing of that these are rooted in wildly false concepts that are completely opposed by the actual truth.
Absolutely. I'm of the persuasion that the truth will do. And yet, because the truth doesn't favor their agenda, people who are opposed to abortion just want to deal with anything but the truth. You know, I thought about the irony. I was like, you know, if we regulated guns the way we regulated women's bodies, we'd have a much safer society. We trust people with guns more than we trust a woman with the decision about her body and what to do with a pregnancy. But to your point that you were making, I cringe and I marvel at the fact that no other aspect of medicine, given my belief that abortion is healthcare, is scrutinized, regulated, and targeted and has such targeted rules regarding it as abortion. Abortion is the only area that does that, and I think it's rooted in the fact that we simply refuse to trust women with the important decision of what to do with the process going on in their bodies. It is the ultimate disrespect, and it's the ultimate mark of patriarchal power and chauvinism to govern and to regulate a process so highly and so tightly that is exclusively the domain of a woman's health and her reproduction.
Let me ask you this. You said that the political conversation around abortion has obliterated the truth and crushed any nuanced understanding of what it means to live a human life. And I thought that was a pretty powerful statement to make. Let's talk about that. Explain to people what you mean by that.
Well, you know, I think life, as I said, I think in some ways, slogans and phrases and jingles are designed to undermine critical thinking. And so the fact that people have in a very ahistorical and very recent effort to gain political power, they've changed the notion of what, you know, the institution and the agency that has the most interest in describing why life is has made the understanding of what life is a moving target. You know, the church, in terms of when the church had to deal with the notion of reproduction, It says that ensoulment or life began when the soul entered into a body. So if one conceived and that body grew, as we know it does biologically in pregnancy, the understanding used to be that ensoulment or life didn't begin until quickening, or the first time that a woman could feel the fetus move, which has routinely been in early pregnancies, in first pregnancies at 20 weeks. And so according to that religious understanding, life began at that point, which is not the same as saying life begins at conception. So when I've tried to say that reproduction has scientific and biologic relevance, and for people who are trying to understand it and explain it, it has non-empiric or non-scientific value. And I think that those two things don't have to compete, but they often do, because people who want to control power, and in this case, control the lives and the bodies of women, seek to control reproduction because reproduction plays out in the bodies of women. So when somebody is saying, with regard to this whole conversation about the morality of abortion, and they offered their rationale that all life is sacred and life begins at conception, I say respectfully to that person, I respect your right and your ability to believe that, but when you say life begins at conception, you've given a non-scientific understanding of what life is. Life can't begin at conception when you have to have a live sperm and a live egg in order to have a live conception. So what that means is life has to begin before conception, and life is therefore a process and not an event. And then when I say that, I'm not belittling the fact that people, from a religious standpoint, can say life begins at conception and declare the intent of a greater power and a greater being. You know, I'm free to understand that in that way as well. But when it comes to controlling the bodies and the lives of women, the allowing people who have a certain religious understanding about reproduction that is not in any way linked to the scientific realities is to position ourselves as a society, as we've done, to deny women access to the very vital service of abortion, which is necessary for them to control their lives and to protect their health.
Now, you've gone on quite a journey in your life. You've started out after you trained as a doctor and you were starting out in your practice. You went from not providing abortions, and even though you would say that, you know, well, if a woman came up to you and told you she wanted an abortion, she needed one, you would, you know, suggest that they go to another doctor that would provide the abortion. But you've gone from that kind of a position to actually providing abortions, and each time there's been a sort of a big incident that happened that actually pushed you in a certain direction when you sat back and thought about it. And you've gone from not doing abortions to actually becoming one of the major abortion providers in the country, and in a gathering of people, a group of people that actually has really, what, it's sort of shrunken by 50% or more in the last decade or so or more. And it's very heavy when you look at this, because you also now have ended up where this is not only your primary work, but you're a leading spokesperson around this in terms of fighting for people to recognize a woman's right to an abortion, but also the fact to recognize the woman's humanity. And I wanted to ask you this. Most recently, or I guess actually the most recent move you've made, involved something called My Sister's Keeper and a person named Susan Yanow. And I wanted you to tell people about that, because I thought that was a very, very important moment in your life when you decided to work with her.
Well, when I became aware of the access issues in the South, when I became an abortion provider, I was sympathetic and understood that, but my life course had me. I left the South when I was 18 years old, and growing up in the South and dealing with racism and the limitations that I found that until I left, I like having grown up in the South. I love the people. I love the region. But when I left as an 18-year-old, I thought the South was a better place to be from than to be in, and I had no immediate intentions to go back. But when I was asked to do a survey if I was willing to travel, and was matched with the clinic in Mississippi as a place that had open services but had a limited number of providers, I went and visited and made my decision to go home. So it was the effort of Susan, who does work worldwide, to make sure that women have access to the often life-saving care that is abortion, that she was making an effort to make sure that doctors who were trained to provide abortion were identifying the areas where the need was, and that if at all possible, trying to prompt us to consider going to the place where the need is. That just resonated with me, and it kind of upstaged my path that I was on, I'd already made my decision to leave Hawaii to pursue abortion training. On the day that Dr. Tiller was assassinated, I had already made my decision to step more fully into abortion care by becoming the medical director of Planned Parenthood and to no longer provide advanced gynecologic care or obstetrics. But the crisis moment, it was, in Hawaii, when I made the decision to get the training, I was in a situation where I had to decide if I was going to stand up for what I knew was right. But the crisis moments for me have not been per se something that happened to a particular patient or something that happened to me. It's been an ongoing pursuit of what it means to live conscientiously and to be self-aware and both also aware of what the world that I live in and where it's going and what my role is to make sure it goes in a direction that values the humanity of all of us as people. So if anything, it's always been a recognizing for me, what can I live with? And when I become aware of an injustice, particularly one that I have specific skills to address, it basically becomes a crisis of conscience. I often say that someone said that when you wrestle with your conscience and you lose, you actually win. And I lost that first battle 15 years ago in Hawaii. And, each subsequent decision, like going to full-time practice of abortion care with the understanding that many other people will do the other part, but there are men and women where nobody will help them, and I wanted to make myself available to the women that no one else would help. That decision, as well as the decision to go home to where the need was, even though that was hypothetically placing me more at risk.
And on top of that, and this will be the last question, but on top of that, there also seems to run through your entire book and actually through your life, this idea that particularly since you started doing abortions and offering abortions to women and fighting for that right, for women to have that right, you sort of have rooted yourself in the understanding that women actually are the agents of their own lives and futures. And that's a fairly important and very, very controversial concept in the world today.
It has to do with, you've taken me back to what that root. It's easy to fathom, and I get a lot of people who want to give me credit for being a man doing this work. And that would, for me, I'm tempted to be flattered by that, that would root my work in a sense of chivalry. And I don't think chivalry has the moral compulsion to make one commit to abortion care. It really comes down to the way I see the world, and that's a one of fundamental fairness, where we are all human beings and our life options and chances should not stratify by the biology that we're born into. I think Abraham Lincoln, in offering one of the rationales for why he ended slavery, made a statement that I think best captures why I do abortion care. When someone asked him why he chose to free the slaves, he said that as I would not be a slave, so I will not be a master. Which is to say that even though he probably did not see enslaved Africans who were newly freed as his social equal, he certainly, in order to make the notion to be pragmatic about saving the Union, he had to see them as his human equal. And I see that women are no different in their humanity than men are. And in fact, I see for men to participate in patriarchy and being willing to subordinate women, we have to, in some ways, be less human than women. And so I chose that I would not be more of a man than a human being, more black than human, more straight than human, or more Christian than human. And so if any of those identities compete with my humanity, I reject them. And so to be more of a man in a patriarchal sense would be to be indifferent to the fact that women need abortion care, and to refuse to stand in solidarity as they liberate themselves would mean that I would have to acquiesce to a manhood rooted in patriarchy, which, in my opinion, makes us less than human.
All right, Dr. Parker, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
All right, we've just been talking with Dr. Willie Parker, and his book is Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. So we're going to take a quick break and be right back.
I opened a bank account when I was 9 years old. I closed it when I was 18. I gave them every penny that I had saved, and they gave my blood and my urine a number. And now I'm sitting in this waiting room.
Welcome back. That was Lost Woman's Song from Annie DeFranco. Now we're going to hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party and the architect of a whole new framework of human emancipation, the new synthesis of communism, popularly referred to as the new communism. This is from a speech late last year before nationwide protests on November 4th.
So we've been going out to people, trying to tell millions of people that we need to drive out this regime before it becomes too late. And something I've learned along the way is that the urgency of this comes from two windows that we're facing that are closing. The one window being, you know, the reality of fascism and how it operates is moving fast to silence and eliminate the opposition, you know, with the way Trump tweeted against flag burning, and then the way that that inspired these state laws, you know, allowing cars to run down protesters and now attacking and intimidating people in the NFL who take a knee, and now, you know, the introduction of COINTELPRO 2.0. And then on the other side, the other window that you have is the normalization that seems like it's growing so much worse every day, especially around the genocide we're facing of North Korea. You know, I was just talking with someone the other night who was just so enraged, and I mean, she felt hopeless because one of the trending, the top five articles on the Huffington Post website that day talked about, like, the headline was literally, we're facing a genocide, they use the words genocide of North Korea. And, you know, millions of people are reading this, and millions of people do know what's going on. But then you get on the train, you get on the bus, you walk down the street, and it's, you would never know that this was happening. It's very difficult. When Trump came to the UN, we knew he was going to give the speech of a fascist. We knew that he was going to threaten North Korea, and he threatened to totally destroy them, not just bomb them, not just take out their regime, to totally destroy 25 million people, and no one protested. And that is so shameful. I mean, we went out in the middle of the day when the speech was going on. There were seven of us. You know, later maybe 100 people came out. It is so shameful that a city of 8 million people won't protest that. And so I know that there are a lot of factors to this, like individualism you were talking about earlier, selfishness, but then there are good-hearted people. I know most of the people I see on the train don't want that to happen. Anyway, so my question is, how are we analyzing, like, in an ongoing way, these two windows and the rate at which they're closing? I know that calling for November 4th was part of this and factored both of those windows into that. But I was really struck by the Reichstag fire example that you gave earlier, because that you said something about it that I hadn't known before. I didn't know that the extent to which people didn't realize what that the Reichstag fire was, the Reichstag fire, essentially, that people then, when the communists, some of them were acquitted for this, they thought, oh, the separation of powers, the checks and balances are working. And that is so the dynamic you see here right now, that, you know, the Muslim ban is in effect right now. And people are making excuses. People are saying the courts will save us. People are saying special investigators, Congress. So yeah, we say millions of people feel the way we do, but if they don't act, does that matter? We say we still have time, but how do we know that we still have time? How do we know how much time we have left? And how will we know if these windows are fully closed? And what will we do if they do close?
Yes. yeah, it's maddening. I mean, it is. The contradiction you're pointing to is extremely frustrating. In other words, there are people with all these sentiments, but they're all looking, you know, it's like, you know, the reggae song by Peter Tosh, you know, Equal Rights. I don't know if you know that song, but, you know, it's a sort of well-known reggae singer who was murdered in the late 80s. And he has a line in the song that's a common saying, I think, in Jamaica. Everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die. And that's kind of what we're facing, you know, is, you know, everybody wishes, you know, that, you know, with a lot of, you know, emotion even, a strong sentiment, wishes this would go away, you know, or this wouldn't go where it seems to be going. But the, you know, the rub is actually getting people to make the sacrifices that are required to deal with this, and rather than just hoping that somehow it's all going to work itself out. And, you know, that I share your sense, you know, of frustration. It's very real. And, you know, I don't think there's a magic solution to that. I will speak to the two windows in a minute, but I do think, you know, that again, we have to struggle with people that, you know, this is not going to get better. The first of all, look, right now, all three branches of government are in the hands of the same people, even with the contradictions that exist. And there are contradictions. You know, you got Senator Corker, Republican, talking about, you know, Trump in very derogatory terms, and Trump tweeting, you know, there's a, you know, and Trump attacks McCain for not voting for the, you know, getting rid of Obamacare, whatever. You know, there are the contradictions, but look, this is a bad situation, a terrible situation. All three branches of government are in the hands of the same people, essentially, and are, you know, are going to, you know, Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, looking into it, it turns out, from what I understand, that his voting record most closely, you know, tracks that of Clarence Thomas. So that tells you what you're dealing with there. So that's a majority on the Supreme Court. So even just looking at it on these terms, you know, even if the lower courts in Hawaii or Washington or do this or that, look, the Supreme Court's going to do what it's going to do, and it's not going to be good. You know, and the Democrats are, you know, look at this thing with, Nancy Piglosi and Schumer, you know. Nancy Piglosi and Schumer are in there, you know, toadying up to Trump, you know, oh, Trump likes me, you know, all this kind of, you know, you think those people are going to solve this problem? They're gonna prevent the horrors from continuing and getting much worse, you know? Or you think somehow, you know, and it's all these illusions. Like I saw a clip from the Michael Moore show on Broadway, and one of the people who was up on the stage with him was saying, well, you know, these politicians, they're going to have to come around and do the right thing because they want to get elected. See, this is exactly the kind of logic that has been so deadly. You know, the politicians, you know, first of all, the way things are set up, these Republican politicians are pretty inoculated from not getting reelected anyway, unless it's some even more, you know, lunatic right-winger who challenges them in the primary. So, you know, you even on that level, you're not gonna, you know, they're not worried. They're not worried about how people who come to a Michael Moore show on Broadway are not gonna vote for them. You know, they're not worried about that, you know, and the more fundamental reason that they do what they do is because, you know, they are part of a machinery that believes that the system that they are ultimately all representatives of needs to go in a certain direction that it's going now with Trump and Pence. So they're not, the Republican Party is not going to all of a sudden come to its senses and be patriotic and put the country ahead of party and blah, 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 blah. That's not going to happen. So, you know, I think we need to get into this with people and say, look, you know, this is, it's hard. I mean, I would be willing to bet that the two of you sitting next to each other have uprooted your lives to some significant degree to be part of this, you know, and others here too, you know, because why? Because of what you recognize that we're talking about, because you recognize, you know, what the stakes are, to put it simply. And we have to struggle with other people that they have to do the same. You know, it's not that we're just, you know, in some trivial way asking people to do something that's unpleasant or that, you know, requires some sacrifice. It's because of the stakes here. And we really have to struggle with people. I don't know any, you know, magic solution other than struggling with people. First of all, we really do have to get out the word. Here's one thing. If people just feel like, okay, you've got good arguments, but you're just one person and there's just a few people, I agree with you. It is an absolute disgrace that when Trump gave that speech, there should have been massive demonstrations all over the country. I mean, you know, look, I don't want to, we were so great back in the good old days. No, you know, people did things because they recognized what was happening, you know, what needed to be done. And as I pointed out, a lot of the people who were very good back in the good old days are not so good now. But one thing, you know, I was thinking of when this happened at the UN was what happened when Nixon bombed Cambodia during the Vietnam War after saying he was not going to expand the war into Cambodia. There was a massive outpouring, especially on the campuses, but broader than that, of people all over the country just poured out spontaneously into the streets. That's when you had the Kent State, you know, assassination of the people demonstrating there. And I saw a program, it was really heavy, I saw a program on CNN, believe it or not, about the Kent State thing. And, you know, after they shot these people, wounded a bunch and killed four people, the National Guard, the protesters regrouped on an area, a grassy area, and they were facing off against the National Guard. And one of the people who was part of the protest said, you know, there was an argument among us about whether we should just charge the National Guard. And somebody said, well, a bunch of us are going to die. And then this person said, other people were saying, yeah, but look what's going on. Now, I'm not saying, just to be clear, no, I'm just trying to describe the character of how people, the intensity of people's, you know, revulsion at this and their determination to do something. That's what I'm talking about. I'm not, again, the point of November 4th is not that people should charge the National Guard and get killed. Just to be absolutely clear, it's not the point that I'm making. The point I'm making is that that should have been, that kind of sentiment, that kind of outrage, that kind of, this is intolerable, we will not stand by while the head of the most powerful state in the world talks about obliterating countries and threatens nuclear war, and people should have been pouring out into the streets. That's my essential point. They should have been pouring out into the streets the way they did around that bombing of Cambodia. That's my point. It's not that they should have charged the National Guard. I was saying that to say what the depth of people's outrage was at that point, that even after the National Guard had killed people, they were debating about whether they should do that again, you know, whether they should go up, and they were unarmed. You know, it isn't like they were talking about going and grabbing arms. They were unarmed, all those people protesting. They were not armed. So that's different than November 4th. Let me make clear again, just so nobody tries to, well, they'll try anyway, but just so any distortions of it cannot stand. That's my point is not people should go charging the National Guard. I'm saying there should be that kind of outrage. I agree with you. And I do think a lot of it is the individualism, but also this American chauvinism is such a big thing. This idea that, you know, we're the good guys in the world. I mean, how many times have you heard a CNN reporter or so on, you know, with their ill-fitting helmet going around with the troops in Afghanistan, talking about, well, we're looking for the bad guys. They were over there on that hill, but it seems they left now. You know, I mean, you know, it's drummed into us, bad guys, bad guys, bad guys, bad actors, bad guys. You know, well, obviously, we're the good guys, you know, is the unchallenged assumption. And that assumption needs to be challenged. And even if you think, and this is the point about broad unity, even if you think that in an overall sense, America is and should be a force for good in the world, how can you stand by and not do anything when the head of that country in that state says what Trump said at the UN? You know, and I think this is the kind of broad unity that needs to be built. You know, we need to struggle with people about this American chauvinism. But even if you've got in your head the idea that America's the greatest country in the world, and really this is an abomination because it goes against everything this country stands for, which it doesn't. But even if that's what you think, you should be outraged and you should be in the street. So I agree with you. This is, I wish I could say there's some easy way to deal with this, but I think the only way to deal with it is to struggle with people. And the other thing is get the word out so that people, you know, there is an effect on people's thinking by struggling with them, but there's also an effect on people's thinking when everywhere they go, they're seeing word of this group of people that's calling for this massive, and they say, oh, well, that's different then. You know, when I was just arguing with you, well, who are you? You know, you might be a nice person, but what are you going to do? But if they get the sense that there is actually a movement here, then it's reaching broadly, and everywhere they go, they're encountering at least the word of this, then that changes people's thinking too. Because a lot of people don't act because they don't want to be the only one to act. And then you get into the vicious cycle. Well, people don't act because they don't want to be the one to act. And a million people don't act because they don't want to be the first one to act. So they have to know about what Refuse Fascism is doing. I get back to that point. Now, quickly on the windows point, because I know other people want to ask questions. I agree with you. There are, these windows are closing. I mean, you know, it's not, that's the limitation of the analogy I gave about the Vietnam War. You know, it's that was different. You're, now, you know, you don't have years and years and years. Maybe you don't even have months and months and months and months to do something about this before it becomes incredibly more difficult to do anything. You know, and the normal channels are not going to solve the problem. And it could become, I mean, it's like what you were saying, you know, there are all these horrific laws that are being proposed and some are being passed that are extremely repressive. And, you know, in all these state legislatures, and this is a weird country where the laws are not federal laws. I mean, there are federal laws, but most of the laws are state laws. It's the whole way the country develops. So, you know, different states have different laws. But there are all these states that are passing under the radar, quote unquote, being passed under the radar that are highly repressive and are aimed at preventing people from actually protesting and demonstrating against anything significant. And people don't know about that, which they should. But we do, this window is closing. And I think that's something people have to be told very bluntly, too. You know, we shouldn't just understand the window ourselves. We should let other people know that, because it's real. It's not like, it's not a hype. Well, you know, this is a good gimmick to get people, we'll scare people into doing it by telling them that window's closing. No, it's actually objectively closing. And we need to, other people need to know that too. We need to understand it. But other people who think that, well, you know, things will work out somehow, need to understand what's actually happening, because that is the reality. And the normalization, you know, I talked about that somewhat, and I agree with you again. That is happening. That is very bad. That, you know, it's, you know, learning to live with fascism is not a good thing. You know, and learning to live with all the particular outrages and the overall direction is very, very bad. And we need to talk to people about that too. Don't fall into the normalization. Every time the mainstream media refers to Trump as the president, a siren should go off in people's heads. You know, that this is the normalization warning should go off, because this is what's happening. You know, they're conditioning people, you know, somewhat subtly or whatever you want to say, that to accept this and to hope that Democrats will get elected and somehow they'll do something they've never done before or whatever. You know, or maybe in 2020 we can vote Trump out. I mean, what is going to happen between now and then, even 2018? You know, so, I just think that as we know about these windows and need to act with the commensurate urgency, other people need to know about it too. I think people need to understand that. And I go back to the word and the sense of a movement out here and the word about really needs to be out there very broadly in society, because that creates more favorable conditions for people to seriously consider, you know, and weigh stepping out of their comfort zone, because they feel that they're doing it with many other people. So that's about what I can say about that. I wish there were something I could say that would make this easier, but we're just going to have to fight through it. Okay.
That was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it was taken from the Trump Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. If you want to watch the entire 1 hour film and the complete Q&A session, go to revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us, and check out refusefascism.org. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. All right, we're going to go out now with She's a Rebel by Green Day.